heart, and that means a lot. And he said, you and I, we can change the world if we believe it.
And Juan, you were wounded with Brent as Brent lay dying. You grew up in Colombia. You lost your father, killed by drug cartels in Colombia. Your final message to people who watch this film tonight, premiering on HBO?
I think one of the takeaways is to hopefully people understand and appreciate the work that we do as journalists. As more and more we're seeing attacks on our colleagues around the world, I hope that one of the messages that they take from this documentary is that the close inside portrait of a brother, a family, and the loved ones, what they go through when they lose a journalist, and what we lose in our democracy is what we lose when we lose a journalist. So hopefully that's what people will take away from this.
And one of the most poignant moments at the end, when people are holding up pictures of journalists around the world who have died, particularly in Gaza, in that other conflict right now, where over 250 journalists have been killed. I want to thank you both for being with us. Juan Arredondo, Craig Renaud. Craig is the director of Armed Only with a Camera, The Life and Death of Brent Renaud. Juan, the producer. It premieres tonight on HBO. And that does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Happy birthday, Robbie Caron.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's nominating committee meeting will be held on Tuesday, October 21st at 5 p.m. This meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is being held.
Tune into KBOO every third Saturday at 10 p.m. for Query.
Dive into the spectrum of queer music as we explore artists across time and genre.
It's on my mind every hour of every day.
That's Query, every third Saturday at 10 p.m. Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. And I lose control, think I follow home.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield calls for a full court review of the case against National Guard deployment in Portland. The government shutdown means SNAP food assistance funds runs out at the end of the month. And new reporting demonstrates neglect and abuse at ICE facilities. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, October 21st, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. Oregon Attorney General Dan Rayfield is calling for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to rehear the case blocking Trump from deploying the National Guard to Portland. Judges ruled 2-1 in favor of the president's ability to bring in federal troops, even if the situation on the ground doesn't match the law's stated requirements. Now, Rayfield is calling for a review of the case by the full Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The dissenting judge, Susan Graber, requested the same, a full en blanc decision. This type of full bench review by judges is usually reserved for very important or complex issues. Judges will likely vote on whether to review the case this week, with briefs due from both sides by midnight tomorrow. Changes to the Continuum of Care program could mean more people in Oregon and across the country lose funding for housing. Oregon was awarded about $65.5 million in Continuum of Care grants last year that are redistributed to the state's most vulnerable residents. Isabel Charlet reports.
The Trump administration plans to make large cuts to permanent housing supports and direct funding instead to temporary housing assistance with requirements for work or service. That's according to leaked documents from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. HUD estimates the changes to the continuum of care funding would strip more than 170,000 people of their housing assistance. Laura Golino de Lovato is with Northwest Pilot Project in Multnomah County. She says COC funding is critical for helping the state's most vulnerable populations to find housing, including seniors, families, survivors of domestic violence, and youth.
We're likely to see more people staying in shelter longer, more people becoming homeless, and more people facing eviction. And it is driven very much by what is happening at the federal level.
Oregon was awarded about $65.5 million in continuum of care grants last year, distributed among the state's five regional COC programs. Under the new plan, overall funding for the program would stay the same, but funds to support permanent housing would be reduced to less than a third. Proponents of prioritizing temporary housing say the change is intended to promote self-sufficiency. Golina de Lovato says that idea does not reflect reality.
That argument might hold water if wages were very high and rent was extremely low, and if human beings didn't age and have disabilities.
She explains there are people who will never be able to make enough money through work to support themselves and their families, especially in areas where rent is high. But Golino de Lovato says even though the situation is bleak, support from wealthy individuals and a regional high earner in business tax give her hope that Oregon's spirit of compassion will pull the state through this challenging time.
There are people who care in our community who don't want to see youth and families with children and seniors homeless or in shelter. And I really think that together we're going to find a way to get there.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Oregonians on food stamps will need to have a positive balance in their account to get benefits after the end of the month. There won't be any new benefits. That's the situation if the federal government shutdown persists. SNAP has funding available for benefits and operations only through October. On Monday, the Oregon Department of Human Services began notifying the more than 750,000 people currently receiving benefits through SNAP that they will not get benefits after October 31st. Benefits usually get deposited into accounts the first week of the month. More than half of Oregonians that receive benefits are seniors, children, or people with disabilities. Governor Tina Kotek said of the situation, quote, "This is a cruel and unacceptable situation. President Trump should focus on feeding families by negotiating a deal with Congress, not doing other things like deploying troops in American cities on taxpayers' dime." Approximately 42 million individuals across the nation will be affected. It is also unclear how long it will take to turn SNAP benefits back on once Congress passes a spending bill. That's because Oregon contracts with a third-party processor that deposits money to people's electronic benefits transfer account. That same processor contracts with about 30 other states, meaning they will have to process millions of accounts at the same time. The announcement comes as Oregon began tightening eligibility requirements anyway to comply with federal changes passed through Congressional Republicans' One Big Beautiful Bill. Those changes include new work requirements in rural Oregon communities that had often been exempted. That federal spending bill also added new work requirements for people experiencing homelessness, veterans, and former foster youth. Refugees and asylum seekers are no longer eligible for any SNAP benefits. More than 3,500 retailers statewide participate in SNAP, generating $1.50 to $1.80 in economic activity for every dollar spent. The Truth Behind These Walls, a new report released by a coalition of immigrants' rights organizations, presents firsthand accounts of conditions faced by people being held at GEO Group's ICE detention facility in Aurora, Colorado. Eric Galatas has more.
A new report from a coalition of immigrant rights organizations offers firsthand accounts of conditions faced by people held at GEO Group's ICE Detention Center in Aurora. Lack of access to medical care, food, and inadequate staff training are top concerns. Andrea Loya with Casa de Paz, Colorado, says detention is not a necessary step in the immigration process. Colorado residents don't have to be behind bars as they await their hearing dates. She believes the only motive for incarcerating immigrants is to line line the pockets of private companies.
When you inject a profit motive into a system of incarceration, you are creating an inherent and dangerous conflict of interest. A corporation is going to make it its primary duty to its shareholders, not to the people that it actually needs to care for.
The report notes people living in the Aurora Detention Center must wait at least 3 days to see a medical staff member, even for emergencies. In August, a woman who had sent in 5 requests for care was told that there was only 1 doctor available for the whole facility. The report also cites examples of people with chronic conditions not being able to access medications and inadequate care for expecting mothers. GEO Group has not yet responded to a request for comment. Lack of access to nutritious food was a common concern, and as the number of people being held has increased, the problem has become worse. Loya emphasizes that people don't expect a 5-course meal.
People who are detained can feel that there's more people inside of the detention center because their food portions are smaller. People are literally still going hungry with the food portions that they get in detention.
The report's recommendations call upon Colorado's elected representatives at the local, state, and federal level. Gladys Ibarra with the Colorado Immigrants' Rights Coalition says officials should use their full authority to shrink federal detention budgets, to conduct unannounced inspections on ICE facilities, and to protect every person in Colorado, regardless of their immigration status.
Our report lays bare a system of abuse and neglect that is fundamentally at odds with our state's values. The time for silence and inaction is over. Our officials must choose which side of history they will be on.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
Portland Mayor Keith Wilson wrote an opinion piece for the magazine Newsweek detailing his interaction with Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem when she visited Portland. Wilson warns that the ICE facility is a disaster waiting to happen. He writes, quote, "The ICE facility was a mess of overflowing dumpsters, loose body armor and crowd control munitions, and a broken HVAC air conditioning system that raised both temperatures and tempers in the aging building," end quote. Wilson laments the violence perpetrated by ICE agents against the community, including knocking down senior citizens, pepper spraying teenagers, and tear gassing a neighborhood so intensely that a school had to move. He expressed concern for the agents involved, writing, quote, "Most were far from home, overworked and exhausted, while receiving no pay in the midst of a prolonged government shutdown. I can only imagine the family and financial stress they are under as they are forced to make daily, split-second decisions with immense human consequences," end quote. Wilson called on Secretary Noem to change course, saying she is, quote, "running out of time to prevent an accident in Portland." U.S. Senate once again votes down funding to reopen the government as federal workers miss paychecks. The Supreme Court will hear cases on the rights of transgender athletes, and a ruling on voting rights could impact even local elections. With that story and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy and historic times.
I'm perfectly willing to guarantee Democrats a vote, but none of that is going to happen until Democrats reopen the government. We're not going to negotiate on anything until Democrats stop holding government funding hostage.
Republican Senate Majority Leader John Thune blames Democrats as a House GOP stopgap spending bill again fails to advance, the 11th funding measure to fail, with the government shutdown entering its 4th week. Democrats are dug in over saving health insurance subsidies set to expire. Republicans are demanding current funding levels simply be extended. Thousands of federal employees are going to work in spite of not getting paid. Since they're technically still employed, they can't get unemployment benefits. Brent Barron is with the American Federation of Government Employees at the Department of Labor. More than 3/4 of the department's staff is currently furloughed. Barron says federal employees, almost all of whom live and work outside of Washington, get a bad rap.
The vitriol and the anger thrown at the federal employee, I don't know where it comes from, because they're your neighbors. We're all supposed to be the United States of America, and we're so divided right now, it's unbelievable.
A federal appeals court has ruled President Donald Trump can deploy National Guard units across Oregon for now, overturning a lower court order. Trump has called the city of Portland a war zone and said ICE officers operating in the city are under siege. The lower court judge had scathingly dismissed those assertions as entirely unfounded. In just 10 months of the Trump administration, nearly as many undocumented immigrants have died in U.S. custody as during 4 years under President Joe Biden. ICE reports 20 deaths since Trump took office, more than any full year in decades. The administration says it's recruiting more healthcare workers. According to the New York Times, the White House is struggling to keep the right-wing Israeli government from returning to an all-out assault on Hamas in Gaza. Both sides accuse the other of violating the ceasefire Trump negotiated. The Supreme Court is taking up a challenge to an Idaho ban on transgender students playing sports outside of their birth gender. The state was the first to outlaw it 5 years ago, but since then, more than half of all states have followed suit. Shwali Patel with the National Women's Law Center says such bans violate equal protection guarantees built into federal law.
These laws are very concerning because these are flat out denials of opportunity to play sports, and they target a very vulnerable community, and they're discriminatory.
The court is also considering tossing a section of the Voting Rights Act designed to block racial discrimination in the drawing of political boundaries. The case could have a huge impact on congressional redistricting. But Sophia Lakin with the American Civil Liberties Union says the stakes are also incredibly high for local races, which play an outsized role in daily life.
Minority representation came about really only because of the Voting Rights Act. And we have reason to believe that without those protections, you're going to see these districts that elect minority candidates disappear.
I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy as well with a high of 64. Today in history, in 1967, the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam organizes a march of 50,000 people from the Lincoln Memorial to the Pentagon. The quote of the day is from American author and Portlander Ursula K. Le Guin, born this day in 1929. She said, quote, "To learn which questions are unanswerable and not to answer them, this skill is most needful in times of stress and darkness." As the 2025 wildfire season winds down, tribes in Oregon are doing cultural burns to help improve habitat. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. With fire season winding down across many parts of the U.S., it's not unusual to find people doing deliberate burns to eliminate slash or improve habitat. Outside Eugene, Oregon recently, a group of Native youth and state and tribal agencies conducted a cultural burn. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
Five interns of the Long Tom Watershed Council's Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program and a few dozen staff members, fire bosses, and agency employees gathered at the Chilamalee Reserve. The Oak Savannah here provided 3 acres for the interns to apply their knowledge of fire as a tool.
I have learned that a small spark can start a whole field of flames.
Kaneem Cushman Whiteyes is with the Chinook Indian Nation and a middle schooler. He's setting fire to a meadow with a flaming pitch stick, while water trucks and crews of shovels stand by to help keep it within the designated area.
The best thing about using fire is that you can learn so much about it in like a little amount of time, and it can be very healthy for the land.
Nearby, TEIP's program manager, Rachel Cushman, helps her other son, Isaac, set a few fires and keep aware of his surroundings. Fire can reduce acorn weevils or help coniferous trees reseed the area. Cushman says this part of the Willamette Valley has always been a fire-formed landscape.
It's been unhealthy because fire's been missing, and so we're awakening the land, we're building that relationship back up, and healing it through this practice of cultural fire.
A few yards away, TEIP's curriculum director, Joe Scott, helps a few interns extend the fire closer to a camas meadow. Scott is a Tsleil-Waututh tribal member who did a training exchange with the Yurok tribe. Now he's applying all of his accumulated experience to teach the TEIP interns about good fire.
Youth have come up seeing fire as the enemy,
as a destructive force, and this is a perfect example of fire being a constructive force.
Scott says with the fall rains, ash and nutrients will replenish the soil and help the camas prosper. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull, near Eugene.
10 women will be inducted into the Alaska Women's Hall of Fame Tuesday, including Jocelyn Estes, a pioneering Alaska Native journalist. Estes most recently was a national correspondent for Indian Country Today and also worked as news director at KMBA. Estes is Tlingit with ties to Wrangell, but she's not the only Alaska Native to be honored.
Another Alaska Native is my great-grandmother, Tilly Paul Tamry. She was a civil rights leader in the early 20th century.
Estes says it's an honor to be inducted along with her great-grandmother. Two other Alaska Natives are being inducted into the Hall of Fame. Catherine Gottlieb, a Supiaq leader in Native healthcare, who served 30 years as president of South Central Foundation. The late Ada Blackjack Johnson is also being recognized. Johnson was a Inupiaq and the sole survivor of a doomed Arctic expedition in the 1920s. Tribes across the country are recognizing Domestic Violence Awareness Month and sharing resources, including the Chickasaw Nation in Oklahoma. The Chickasaw Nation Department of Family Services says it offers support, including domestic violence prevention and intervention, with a focus on tribal cultural values. The Chickasaw Nation also operates a shelter. A candlelight vigil is planned Thursday for Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Chickasaw Nation Director of Violence Prevention, Janie Locke, says one of the most important things they want to communicate is that victims are not alone and services are available. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Microsoft has ceased providing security updates to its Windows 10 software. Consumer advocates are calling for an extension, claiming the move could create a security disaster for millions of users and send an unprecedented amount of e-waste to America's landfills. Shantia Hudson has more in Alabama.
Consumer advocates in Alabama and nationwide are calling on Microsoft to extend free support for its Windows 10 software. The company has stopped automatic security updates, which affects an estimated 400 million computers worldwide. Nathan Proctor with the Public Interest Research Group says users will need to purchase new devices or downloads or otherwise risk exposing themselves to potential cyber attacks.
So many of the computers that are running it actually don't have the option to upgrade to Windows 11, and they're just kind of stuck.
Proctor says users who want security updates will have to pay or enroll in other Microsoft services, and that the cost for small businesses could add up quickly. Microsoft has extended support for its European customers, but not in the U.S., and has suggested users consider purchasing a new PC. Experts warn the move could also worsen pollution, since discarded electronics release heavy metals like lead and mercury that can leach into groundwater and contaminate nearby rivers and lakes. Microsoft originally claimed Windows 10 would remain current for the supported lifetime of a device at no cost. Consumer and environmental advocates welcomed the news that it would still operate on older machines and help reduce the growing amount of electronic waste. Proctor says an extension of customer support would help prevent a massive surge in junked computers ending up in landfills, but he worries not everyone will make the transition.
You have people needing to replace these computers, and then the people who can't afford to or just ignore those warning messages all of a sudden will become way more likely to fall victim to some kind of cybercrime.
Proctor notes many rural residents and seniors may lack the resources to upgrade their software or purchase new computers, further adding to the digital divide. For Alabama News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
Portlanders have been mourning the local outdoor store, Next Adventure, all summer when owners announced their retirement and the entire inventory went on sale. That's changing. New ownership will be taking the reins, meaning Next Adventure stores won't be going away after all. A coalition of local investors will purchase the business, with a transition taking place over the next 6 months. Next Adventure co-founder Deke Haykamp said in a statement, quote, "We are so excited about the amazing team that has come together to keep the company's legacy alive. Brian and I have had a great 29-year run, and we love this business. It's wonderful to see how many people wanted this community outdoor store to continue on, and we know it's in the very best hands," end quote. The new management will start November 1st, as will ski and snowboard season rentals and used gear trades in the bargain basement. We now go to Global Citizen Commentary from Portland State Professor Emeritus, Mel Gertov. He says the Russia-Ukraine war begs for a plan that would at least halt the fighting. Gertov has a thought. It doesn't resolve the war, but it offers incentives for both sides to stop rather than continue to seek victory. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Intractable conflicts are wars without end, and Russia's war with Ukraine seems to fit the bill. Now 3.5 years old, the war goes on without any sign of a let-up in the violence. Neither side seems willing to give an inch. Both sides seem either to believe in ultimate victory or find insufficient incentives to stop fighting. Their outside supporters continue to provide weapons and military supplies that ensure more destruction and casualties. Russian bombardments are focusing on major Ukraine energy facilities, and Russia is conducting hybrid warfare that includes jet and drone crossings of NATO country territory. Trump said he was considering supplying Ukraine with Tomahawk long-range missiles, then dropped the idea when Russia warned that that would be a serious escalation. No one has offered a well-reasoned peace plan or threatened sanctions severe enough to cause strategic rethinking in Moscow or Kyiv. Now President Trump is scheduled to meet with Vladimir Putin in Budapest, following a meeting of Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky in Washington. After a phone conversation with Putin, Trump is back to believing that Putin wants to end the war, quote-unquote. Yes, he does, reportedly, once Ukraine surrenders the Donetsk region. We're back to square one. Let's do our own homework and consider what might halt, not settle, but halt, this war. To clarify, I'm not aiming at what is fair or just, but about what might be acceptable to both sides as an alternative to continued warfare. In a just world, Ukraine, as the victim of Russian aggression, should be compensated by Russia for its human and material losses, and Russia's leaders should be prosecuted for war crimes. But we live in a world in which aggression often pays, and justice is subject to political bargaining. Thus, the challenge is to imagine incentives that will cause Russian and Ukraine leaders to decide that negotiating is better than fighting, and that painful concessions to the other side are outweighed by the rewards. So here is my outline of an agreement. First, Ukraine and Russia accept a ceasefire overseen by a UN peacekeeping operation. The peacekeeping force will monitor the agreement. It may only be withdrawn with the consent of both parties. Second, Russia will withdraw all military and paramilitary forces that are operating in internationally recognized Ukrainian territory, except for Crimea. Third, Ukraine, as well as the US and the European Union, accept Russia's occupation of Crimea as a political reality, but will not legally recognize it. Fourth, the US and NATO agree that Ukraine will not become a member of NATO so long as Russia withdraws its forces and abides by a pledge of non-interference in Ukraine's affairs. Fifth, the US and NATO agree not to station military units in Ukraine, including training units, but all countries may supply Ukraine with weapons and other military assistance for self-defense. Sixth, the European Union, the US, the UN, and other interested parties agree to provide funds for Ukraine's rebuilding. The European Union will release the approximately $300 billion in frozen Russian state assets as loans to Ukraine. If Russia agrees to reparations for Ukraine, the unfrozen funds will be reduced by that amount. Seventh, the US and the EU agree not to prosecute Russian officials for violations of international law and United Nations conventions, subject to Russian adherence to this agreement. Eighth, the US and the EU agree gradually to remove economic sanctions on Russia and restore normal trade and investment relations, subject to Russia's adherence to this agreement. Ninth, Russia will return all children and other persons forcibly taken from Ukraine. Ukraine and Russia will exchange all prisoners. And 10th, Ukraine and Russia agree that within 1 year of implementation of this agreement, negotiations will begin toward a peace settlement to end the war. Why would Vladimir Putin or Vladimir Zelensky accept such an agreement? After all, Russia gives up occupied land and military leverage on Ukraine's ability to remain a viable country, while Ukraine yields its claim to Crimea and its hope to join NATO. But the incentives for each to accept the agreement are substantial. For Putin, those include resumption of trade and investment relations with the West and the assurance that Ukraine will not become a NATO member. For Zelensky, the agreement promises an end to Ukraine's horrific losses of life and economic assets and the start of rebuilding with outside aid. This agreement will not resolve the war. That can only happen either when one side essentially surrenders or when both sides decide that further fighting is futile. The latter situation seems more likely, and once it comes about, an agreement on terms to halt the fighting will become mutually compelling. Peace will come, however, only when a ceasefire holds for some time. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonia Gonzalez, Simone Perez, Shantia Hudson, and Eric Galatas. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. My guest today is University of Oregon professor and longtime activist Sarah Wald. Sarah is the author of multiple books, and as you'll hear today, she is a profound thinker on a wide variety of issues concerning the conservation and environmental justice communities. This was one of my favorite conversations that I have ever had on this show, in part because Sarah was so game to